us shortly before the accident. We'd even talked about going together, maybe, Ethan and I. He was keen on the idea. My voice trails off momentarily as the memory of our plans sharpens. Images of those days, jogging in London, plotting our next steps, snap before my eyes. But that didn't happen. I stayed in London, writing marketing materials for the exhibits at the aquarium and doing translations of them for French visitors. That old marine biology degree came in handy after all, since it enabled me to have a job near home, which meant I could help out along with my parents. Ethan was so tough, though. Sturdy in his own way. Not saying he was happy about it, but he didn't let it get him down. At least, not like you'd think it could get you down.
That's incredible. It takes a lot of internal strength, I imagine.
He had that, I sigh.
And the rub is, he was actually managing well enough with his lot in life before he came down with an infection. That's what did him in.
I shake my head.
Damn irony of it.
He died because he couldn't fight off a basic infection. But before that, he'd even managed to still work.
He did?
He was an online DJ, so he was fortunate to be able to keep doing a job. Set up a home studio and all that. He drew some contentment, I suspect, from having a modicum of independence. His voice still worked after all, but he was always very physical, an athlete. He wanted to do so many things, travel, explore, run more marathons.
That's why you're training for a marathon, Joy says, like something has clicked into place for her.
I nod. Exactly. It's on the list. Third item. He desperately wanted to do another. So there's a race in Indonesia I'm planning to do in a couple of months. I've always wanted to go there, spend some time wandering around when I'm done.
I hear Indonesia's beautiful.
And warm.
Always a plus.
He wanted to do other things too. He wanted to zip line. Skydive. I shudder at the last one. I told him that I loved him to the depths of the ocean and back, but there was no sodding way I was skydiving for him, so he'd better keep that off his list.
Did he?
She asks with avid interest. Thank the Lord he did. You couldn't get me to skydive if you paid me. But live in Paris is on the list, so I'm doing that. And so is help someone achieve their dream, and that, my voice softens, that I can do too.
You really don't have to do this for free,
she says, her voice thin, like it pains her to accept that there's no fee. I lean closer, locking my eyes on hers. But I want to, Joy. Don't you see?
You'd be doing something massive for me. This isn't just a let's be friends and eat ice cream and sniff flowers and perfume request.
That reminds me how very much I like sniffing her neck. But I'll gladly do that for free too, I wink. She laughs, but then erases the humor a second later.
I really want to be fair and compensate you for your time.
This is fair to me. This is immensely helpful. You'd be doing something vital, I say, my tone intensely serious, brooking no argument. I need to do this.
Griffin,
she says, but I can tell she knows she's not winning this debate. I shake my head and squeeze her hand tighter. Let me. She shrugs, her lips curving in a soft grin.
Okay.
Let's start now, I say, switching to the language she wants to learn. I do what I've been doing for her all along, translating. But this time, I make her say the words back to me. Then I do something that'll drive her crazy. I don't speak English first anymore. During our meal, I talk to her in French about simple things, making her answer in her best stitch-together attempts, correcting her every time she needs it. By the end of the dinner, She looks exhausted. She lays her head on the side of the tablecloth.
May I take a nap now?
I pat her hair. Poor Joy. Dreams aren't always easy. When the bill comes, she reaches for it. I do the same. But she has the check in her fast little fingers already. No, she says, quickly standing. If you're teaching me French for free, I'm paying for dinner. You can't pay for dinner. She scoffs. Try and stop me. She bolts from the table, bag in hand, and strides to the waiter who's clearing another table now.
Voilà. Merci.
She hands him her credit card. She returns to me, a smug smile on her face.
Oh, by the way, one of the things we American women are quite good at is getting what we want, and sometimes that means blowing through a restaurant like a bull in a china shop.
She shimmies her hips in some kind of victory dance that no doubt's supposed to be in your face but makes me want to kick back and watch her move that lush body. I laugh and hold up my hands in surrender. I should be more devastated that I'm not taking her home to screw her tonight, and an hour ago I was. But oddly enough, I'm not feeling that way any longer. Maybe because I'm one step closer to something even more important. Finishing the list. Getting out of town. Wandering across the world as I've always wanted. I've stayed still in London and Paris for the last few years. My innate wanderlust is calling to me. Ethan knew it was a strong force in both of us, and perhaps fulfilling the travel wish would be the easiest one for me. Since we were lads, we wanted to see the world. We'd stay up late, poring over maps and atlases, looking up photos of the craziest, wildest places. Then we'd plot how we'd eventually make our way around the globe. We wrote endless lists of our eventual conquests. We pushed pins into maps of the world, intrepid explorers plotting our trips. The Northern Lights in Iceland, the crystal blue waters lapping beaches in Thailand, the neon streets of Tokyo. We'd sleep under the stars when we had to, and when we chose to. As we traversed South America, checking out the tip of Argentina after we travelled through Buenos Aires, we'd hit every continent. We'd avoid the Amazon on account of anacondas, and we vetoed Mount Everest too after reading Into Thin Air, one of the many adventure stories we tossed back and forth, its pages dog-eared many times over. I'm not going to die on a snow-capped mountain with icy air blasting me, he'd say when we were in school. When I go, it had better be on some tropical island surrounded by women in bikinis serving me drinks. When I go, they won't be serving me drinks, I'd said, always upping the ante. They'll be serving me. In your dreams. In the end, that's all they were to him. But not forever, since I'm still here to live them. Some have already come true, and more will, including another one now, thanks to the woman smiling at me by the door, waiting. We leave the restaurant, strolling down the avenue as the soft golden lamplight bathes the streets.
The lights in Paris are different than any place else, Joy says, pointing to the lanterns. There's almost a magical sort of glow to them.
That's true, I answer in French. She shoots me a smirk.
You're a very strict teacher.
I laugh, shifting to English so nothing is lost in translation. Be a good student or I'll bend you over the desk and spank you. Her eyes light up.
Maybe I want to be bad now.
I nearly groan, wanting that too. Wanting all of that. Maybe I do still wish she'd made the other proposition. But for now, I'll have to be content with being her friend, her translator, and her teacher.
When should our lessons begin?
She asks. What are you doing tomorrow after work? She points at me.
Learning French with you.
I nod and smile. You're correct. And that does sound like an excellent recipe for a perfect Friday evening activity. The only thing that might make it better is where it takes place. I slow my pace and whisper my idea. Joy's green eyes turn bright and glittery.
Elise did say I should partake in all the pleasures in life. She says I need more fun. As I wander home later, I find myself wondering why she needs it.
Chapter 15. Joy. If someone were to cross-examine me under oath, before God and country, I could say without fear of perjury that I've indeed found heaven on earth. My always working overtime nose has never been happier. I lean over the display case in the cool, air-conditioned, chocolate-scented bliss known as Jean-Paul Evin near the Eiffel Tower, and my mouth waters. I will literally drool on the counter if I don't keep my jaw shut, and I don't care. Because chocolate. We're talking chocolate the likes of which my taste buds have never encountered before. Forget fancy candy bars from upscale grocery stores back home. This is the Gucci of chocolate shops. This is my Louboutin-loving heart coming home to roost among my favorite things. Treats, luxuries, exquisite tastes. I point at a chocolate square beneath the glass. "What is that?" I ask the perky blonde clerk, like an eager 7-year-old pawing at a delectable goodie. Griffin admonishes me. "En français." I narrow my eyes at him, then direct my question again to the woman in the black linen dress behind the counter. She answers, and her words are gibberish to me. But I find a response. With a satisfied grin, I declare, "Sapelipopette! Gadzooks!" Griffin's hand flies to his belly, and he nearly doubles over in laughter.
"Now you're really loufoquering."
Honestly, last night I thought we were going to slide right into loufoquering. When he held my hand under the table, I was entranced, utterly swept off my feet by the unexpected physical contact and the intensity of it, too. More so by what that little bit of contact did to me. It sent me soaring. For a few moments at the restaurant, I truly thought he was going to seduce me, take me back to his flat and pin me to the door, cage me in with those lean, ropey arms and kiss the breath out of me. I'd have let him. Despite what a horrid idea it would have been, I'd have given in, I'm sure of that. I'd been on the cusp of falling into him, and then everything shifted when I uttered my proposal. But that's how humans are. We are designed to be malleable, to change gears quickly when need be. Now, my gear is in feed-me-chocolate mode. The woman behind the counter grasps a pair of chocolate tweezers and reaches into the case. "She has chocolate tweezers," I say in a stage whisper. Griffin repeats that in French. I straighten my shoulders and aim to impress him when I change the sentence the teeniest bit and say to the clerk, "You have chocolate tweezers." She smiles. "Very good. Your French is very good." She's lying. She's telling a bald-faced lie. But she's so sweet, and she has her paws on the chocolate I want in my belly, so I simply say, "I have a good teacher." When the blonde places the dark chocolate ganache in my hand, I step away from the counter, ready to pop it into my waiting mouth and let the chocolate melt on my tongue. Griffin has other ideas. He closes my fingers over the sweet. I whimper. He says something, and I furrow my brow, trying to understand. He slows down.
"I need something from you."
I nod. "Yes?" He glances at my hand.
"Tell me what it smells like."
"What?" I ask as if he's gone nutso. "Why?" He speaks in English.
"You have this amazing nose, don't you?"
I laugh. It's not amazing, it's just well exercised. He arches a naughty eyebrow.
"Like my mouth."
Tingles spread across my chest. This man, everything he says can sound dirty and delicious. I'm pretty sure he knows it, too. He does it on purpose. It's almost as if he loves to remind me that we were once going to have a brief and potent Parisian affair. I wouldn't really know how well exercised your mouth is, I say coyly. Then, because he started it and why shouldn't I continue it, I tap his top lip with my finger. A little growl is my reward. I open my hand and bring the chocolate in it to my nose, letting the decadent aromas spread to my brain. Berries and lime juice. Then I hold it under his nose. Do you smell berries? He closes his eyes and sniffs. He looks so vulnerable here with his eyes shut in the middle of the store, trying to reconnect with one of his senses. I steal this moment to study his face. Those cheekbones I noticed the first day I saw him, prominent but not too sharp. That square jaw, so masculine. His lips, soft and full. The shape of his handsome face. Sometimes there's a faint trace of stubble on his jawline, but mostly he's clean-shaven. And I like the smooth look. I like watching him, too, wondering what's going on behind those closed eyes.
A little.
He answers at last, and in French. Holy smokes, I understood him. He arches a brow.
Raspberries?
I know that word, too, courtesy of all the raspberry tarts I've snapped up at the upscale patisseries I've been frequenting. Good thing I've been walking all over this city. I need the footwork to burn off my tart work. I think this one is blackberries, but you're close, I say excitedly, switching back to English now. He doesn't correct me as I continue. And then, when you bite into it, try to smell the zippy notes of the lime juice in it. Even with his eyes closed, his expression is quizzical. His eyes scrunch more.
Smell it when I taste it.
I squeeze his shoulder. Smell and taste are connected. Things taste even better when they smell amazing. Scent enhances taste. It's the whole kit and caboodle. His lips quirk.
If you say so.
He parts his lips the slightest bit. I linger briefly on the alluring vision in front of me and the way a hot spark spreads down my chest as I stare at his mouth. Like a voyeur. But a voyeur he's invited in. I put the chocolate square on his tongue. He chews and murmurs. His eyes open, and the blue in them is brighter than before.
It's good.
See what I mean?
Now I'm supposed to see a smell. You nose people are so very complicated.
I laugh. Did you smell the lime and the berry? He shrugs.
Maybe.
My shoulders sag. And that would be a no.
Sorry, he whispers, but it was tasty.
I screw up the corner of my lips, considering. Okay, I have an idea.
Say that in French, Joy. I've been slacking off with you.
I groan, but then this is a sentence I can manage. I do as I'm told, then I return to the counter and ask for several more squares. I order two hot chocolates as well. And soon we head to a small table in the back corner of the shop with a tray of chocolates and two cups of frothy chocolat chaud. Yes, this is heaven. I give him the Earl Grey ganache, telling him to search for the smoky flavor of the infused tea. Surely, being English, you know what Earl Grey tastes like, I say.
Clearly, since there's nothing better than a cuppa.
Oh, I bet this hot chocolate will be better than tea. But go on. I wave at the treat. He takes a bite, and with intense focus he seems to hunt for the smoky scent.
I can sort of taste it, sort of smell it.
He hands me the rest of the square, and I pop it into my mouth.
How do you have such a good nose?
I shrug happily. Anyone can learn to distinguish smells with precision. But for me, it's my job. You just train your nose. The more you use it, the better your olfactory sense becomes. Since we're talking about talents, my curiosity turns to his impressive skills. By the same token, how are you so good with languages? You know Spanish too, right? He grins.
and Italian, and I'm learning Portuguese.
You're learning a fifth language?
He nods. I take classes.
Is that on your bucket list?
He shakes his head. Nope. I mean, it's not on Ethan's list. But, yeah, I suppose it's on mine in a way, even though I don't have a bucket list. It's just something I've wanted to do, so I'm doing it. I love languages. Always have.
Why?
I love the way you can play with words, and how different combinations of words mean entirely different things. It's like a crazy puzzle. If you put the pieces together correctly, you can do the most incredible thing.
He spreads his arms out wide.
Communicate.
I flash him a smile. Communication is incredible. I realize that more every day when I fail at the most basic forms of it.
He shakes his head. Don't think of it as failing. Think of it as relearning, reworking the basics.
I like that attitude. My mind catches on something he said in the elevator my first day of work. You said something about a hospital, that your nose had been terrible since then, and that's why you couldn't make out the lilacs very well my first day of work.
Yes. He stares up at the ceiling. I suppose it's right around then, if I were to try to pinpoint.
That's probably because the smells in it were so antiseptic.
He nods. Yes, cold. All the smells were so cold.
I nod, puzzling together why he says he can't pick up the scents well. I think you shut it down, your sense of smell. There were so many unpleasant ones, and they brought painful memories along with them. Our sense of smell is closely tied to the portion of our brain that controls memories.
Yours was linked with something that hurt you, so you kind of subconsciously turned off your nose.
He tilts his head.
You think so?
I do. It's not unusual. We sometimes shut down things that bring us pain. I raise my hand, miming turning off a knob. But I can turn it back on for you.
He inches closer. I've no doubt you can turn it on.
I roll my eyes. Has anyone ever told you that you're an irrepressible flirt?
Did you mean an irresistible flirt?
Yes, that too.
As a matter of fact, yes. A gorgeous redhead did about 10 seconds ago.
Those sparks, they flare harder, brighter, faster. Tingles spread over my shoulders, and a charge rushes down my body. But we don't linger too long on dangerous ground, because he flips the switch once more, repeating himself in French. I return to my mission of the moment, too, retraining his nose, helping him relearn, so to speak. I reach for another chocolate, then another, guiding him through the scents and tastes. This one has a hint of pepper. This tastes cool because there's the faintest bit of mint. This one, oozing with caramel, should taste warm and sweet on the tongue. His eyebrows wiggle.
Warm and sweet on my tongue.
He repeats himself in French. You have a dirty mind, I say, pointedly. And now we're back here again.
I do. And you do nothing to make it clean.
He winks at me, then he clears his throat.
But thank you for giving me such a fantastic sensory experience on a Friday night.
He runs his finger down the end of my nose and I shudder. That's not supposed to feel erotic. That's not supposed to be sexy. But he doesn't tap my nose. He doesn't squeeze it. He slowly brushes the tip with his finger. And somehow that faintly sexy gesture sends shivers across my skin. Then we talk. As we drink our hot beverages, we chat about the chocolate, the weather, the day. And it's as if a key in a lock turns just the slightest bit, giving me hope that the door might eventually open for me. Not today, not tomorrow, but perhaps soon I might be able to converse in this country's language without him. When we finish, Griffin clears the cups and the tray, then offers me a hand. We exit, but once we hit the street, I hold up a finger and tell him I'll be right back. Wait for me.
I will.
I turn to go get the one last thing I want for him. But as I glance back over my shoulder, I see him waiting. He tucks his hands into the pockets of his jeans, and here on the sidewalk outside the Chocolatier, with the lights of the tower behind him, he's what I want to photograph. I want to snap this shot, post it on Instagram, and hashtag it Boyfriend Aspirations. As soon as that thought lands, I mentally smack myself. I'm not 16, I'm 30. But in my defense, he's completely photo-worthy, and I have no doubt the ladies of Instagram would love this image. Instead, I take a mental picture because I want to remember Griffin waiting for me on the street, patiently, with a smile that reaches all the way to those bright blue eyes. He's not checking his phone, grumbling, or grimacing. He's waiting, happily, for me. Hustling back into the shop, I order one last item from the clerk. She gives it to me and wishes me a good night. I yank open the door, hand him the wrapped treat, and say, voila. He arches a brow curiously as he opens the paper. A smile plays on his lips.
I've been waiting for a chocolate tart from you.
He takes a beat.
Thank you.
His voice is soft, and our eyes hold. He looks at me like he did in the restaurant, with desire, with longing. He leans closer, dusting his lips to my cheek.
Merci.
I die. My knees go weak, my stomach executes cartwheels. It's the barest touch, but I want to cup my hand on my cheek and hold that kiss close all night long. I'm not supposed to want this from him, but I want it. Oh, how I want it. Then it hits me. He's not kissing me. He's saying goodbye, European style. The other cheek will come into play any second. My heart drops, knowing the evening is ending. Are you leaving? Are we done? My voice rises, and I can't hide that the thought makes me feel bereft. I want more of his words, more of this conversation, more of his finger on my nose, his willingness to taste new things, his confidence in teaching me. I want the night with him to unfurl into whatever comes our way. He doesn't kiss my other cheek. Instead, he shoots me a sexy, lopsided grin that ignites the butterflies in my chest once more. He scoffs.
Done? We're not done in the least. In fact, I'm still waiting to learn something about you, Miss Danvers Lively.
He gestures to the sidewalk. I could skip with happiness. The night isn't over at all. We're going to have a twilight walk in Paris, and I do believe I'll be going to bed on a cloud tonight. This is a dream. What do you want to learn?
You said something last night that piqued my interest. Your friend, Elise, told you that you needed more fun. Why? What was unfun about life in Texas?
My chest tightens. Here we go. Why would you think it was unfun? I toss back, since a part of me doesn't want to ruin the flirty vibe with the archaeological excavation of my pre-Paris life. He taps his chin, adopting a studious look.
Could it be that when we first met, you said you just got out of a bad relationship and you weren't looking for anything serious? Busted.
But I'm busted, too, with the stark reminder of why I can't back him up against the glass wall of the boulangerie we're strolling past and kiss him hard with the cobbled streets of the Rue de Grenelle as our witness. Because my last relationship weighed me down. It entangled me. In my experience, relationships are chains around my ankles. When you're finally free, you don't check yourself back into the asylum. I'm finally finding myself again in Paris. I'm stepping into the person I've wanted to be. I can't fall into the mistakes I've made in the past. I was involved with someone for a few years, I admit. At first, it was good, like most relationships are at the starting line. true. If they weren't, we likely wouldn't begin any, he says as we wander down the street. I offer a half-hearted smile at the sentiment. It's both true and a little sad that so many relationships start, and yet so many end. As for my ex, he wasn't a bad person, and we clicked at first. But after a year, I grew apart from him. It just happened. I didn't feel the same for him anymore. I wanted more out of life, out of work, and he didn't. There was no big fight, no big reason. It was just one of those things. He shoots me a quizzical look. No reason at all. I hold up my right hand as if I'm taking an oath. None, I swear. No cheating, no lying. Just no longer feeling like we had anything to talk about. I tried to get the spark back, but when he didn't put in the same effort, I felt more alone. I was ready to end it. And that's when he fell from a ladder at work. Griffin recoils. What? He's a contractor. He was working on a house. It was a workplace accident. He injured his back. That's awful. Exactly. I couldn't end it then. You couldn't? Griffin sounds thoroughly flummoxed. Of course not. My response is crisp and clear. That would be cruel. The man was in the hospital for a few days. He was in pain. He could walk, yes, but he was in constant pain from the injury. Right. Sure. But why fake your feelings? He presses. I didn't fake my feelings entirely. He was still a friend. He wasn't a jerk, I say, bristling at the direction this conversation has taken. We stop at the boulevard, and the light ticks as I wait for it to change from red to green. We're nearing Champ du Mars, the park that rings the most famous icon of France. Well, that's good, but why stay together if you didn't love him anymore? He makes it sound like it was such a simple answer, but there was nothing easy about those times. I cared about him as a person, Griffin. I couldn't just leave him when he needed someone. His family wasn't in town, and he was trying to get back on his feet. His family should have helped him, Griffin says resolutely. They should have come to town. Well, they didn't. I wrap my arms around my chest, irritation brewing rapidly in me. I don't like being judged for my choice. Look, I stayed because it was the right thing to do. He needed help, and I was the only one there. When I originally planned to break up with him, I was no longer in love, but he was still a good friend, a stable guy. Then he was injured, and over time he grew addicted to painkillers, and he turned into a completely different person. He questioned everything I did. He wore me down. He became manipulative. He wasn't like that before. The man he was when I finally left wasn't the man he was when I wanted to leave. A year later, he was someone I no longer even recognized. He wasn't someone I loved. And he was no longer a friend, either. We stop at a tree inside the park, darkness shrouding us. I stare at Griffin, my eyes hard. You're judging me, and I don't like it. The harsh reality is he'd probably judge me even more if he knew I let myself become consumed by the madness. The drama of an injured, addicted Richard was a powerful storm, and I was caught in it. I let myself be dragged down. I let his health and my own deep, potent desire to try to fix him become more important than my goals and dreams. Maybe that's what I really don't like. I felt like I was losing myself then, and Griffin calling me out on it makes it all the more real. He reaches for me, but I back up. I didn't mean to judge. I was just trying to understand what happened, and I'm sure it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. But it's like you're saying I made the wrong choice, when I hardly feel I had a choice to make at all, I say, my pitch rising. I'm sorry, Joy, I didn't mean to be harsh. I can tell this is a sensitive topic, and I don't want you to think I was judging you. I purse my lips. I feel like a fool now. Please don't. He tucks a finger under my chin. I think it just
bothered me that you were with this guy when you didn't want to be. I swallow, wishing he'd take that hand off me, and wishing equally that he'd spread his fingers over my jaw and tug me close, pull my body next to his and let me sink into his arms. I wanted to do the right thing, I say, softer this time. Does that make sense? His smile is gentle.
It does. And I do understand. I was just feeling retroactively protective of you.
I smile back. That's kind of strangely sweet. Thank you.
So few people want to do the right thing, but you did.
I did what made sense at the time.
Different things make sense at different times.
His voice goes low, smoky almost. The sound threads into me as if I'm drawing it into my body. My chest zings. His hand is still on me, holding my chin. He's looking at me like I'm the thing that makes the most sense to him right now, like we make sense. My entire body pulses with energy, with longing. Kiss me. Don't kiss me. Take me. Let me go. I call upon some store of resistance that I've evidently packed inside me for moments just like this. I should go. He drops his hand from my chin.
Touch me again.
Okay, I'll walk you home.
We head past the tower. The park in front of it is teeming with lovers. So many lips are locked together right now.
We need a picture in front of the Eiffel Tower, he says in French.
We do. When I stand next to him, he wraps his arm around my shoulder, and everything about the way he holds me possessively makes so much more sense than it should. His fingers curl over my shoulder, clasping me tight to his side. Our hips touch. I could turn my head and bury my nose in the crook of his neck. Inhale his aftershave, and learn if it lingers on his skin this late into the evening. Taste him. My body is a drum, beating loud and hot. I grip my phone harder, trying to channel all my physical energy into the simple act of lifting it. On the screen, I catch a quick glimpse of a man and woman who look like all the other lovers here tonight. Grinning, touching, kneading. But we're not like these real couples. I snap a selfie and show it to him quickly.
Good one. I like it.
Me too. That's the problem. I like it too much. I drop the phone into my purse, relief flooding me, since somehow I managed to take that picture without tossing the phone to the ground, yanking him against me and saying screw everything, including me.
Hashtag it a night in Paris.
Maybe I will.
Send it to me later, yeah?
Of course. He tucks my hair behind my ear and turns me to face him.
Joy.
My name comes out importantly. I meet his eyes. They're vulnerable again.
Maybe it's good, in some terribly selfish way, that you stayed with him as long as you did, since that means you're here now.
Tingles spread all over me, and my heart is full of starlight. I'm dangerously close to melting, but somehow I manage to whisper a merci before we leave the park. Later, when I'm home, I run my finger over the shot of us, looking like Friday night lovers, looking like we want to kiss, to touch, to spend the rest of the evening together. I don't post it to Instagram. It feels private, this hashtag a night in Paris. I send it only to him. Then I turn off my phone before he can reply.
Chapter 16. Griffin. 8 miles. Around the edge of Parc de Bagatelle, one of the biggest green spaces in the city, the pale pink light of dawn burns off as the sun rises in the morning sky. My heart pounds against my chest as my feet hit the hard-packed earth, and my playlist blasts a random mix of new indie bands in my ears. When I first buckled down for the marathon prep, I tried to listen to my Duolingo app during my training runs, but I found at the end I remembered close to nothing of Portuguese. When I run, I get so lost in the movement I can't focus on words, only rhythm, so I let this eclectic mix power me through. As I leave the park, racing past a museum dedicated to the works of Monet, I have the fleeting thought that Joy would probably like that museum. I bet she likes Monet. I bet she'd gaze at the prettiest paintings in the same way she stares longingly at a piece of chocolate, a pink door, or a window box bursting with flowers. The woman loves beauty in all its forms. She devours it with her senses and feasts on it. I try to shake away the thoughts. If I keep thinking about Joy this much, I want to spend every second with her. Oh, wait, I already do. For now, I refocus my brain on the simple act of putting one foot in front of the other, in moving one step closer to completing an all-important item on Ethan's list, running the marathon in Indonesia. I picture checking it off the list, another accomplishment. Originally, I planned to explore the islands and train at the same time, but I flipped that order around, training here now. As I switch over to a quieter street to cut across the city, I flash back to the dream I had when I was younger, running a marathon. It was so crystal clear, and it came out of the blue, inserting itself into my brain unexpectedly. At the time, a marathon seemed so easy, something I could pull off in a cinch. It's not easy. And yet, I don't mind that it's hard. I don't mind that it hurts. I rather like the burn in my legs and in my lungs. I keep up the punishing pace as I near the 9-mile mark, cruising past apartment buildings, then a Monoprix, and a nearly deserted Starbucks. Even at 8 a.m. on a Saturday, the coffee shop is nearly empty. We're not a country of early risers, I think with a smirk. Then I blink. What a strange notion. They're not early risers, I mean. I'm not from here, so I don't know why I included myself in that sweeping statement about the French. I'm just a visitor, really, making a prolonged pit stop on my itinerant journey around the globe. By the time I hit 9.5 miles, a fresh burst of energy surges inside me and I feel as if I'm flying, even as my muscles are wrung out. A new song starts, a fast, soaring number that's like a burst of adrenaline. Another minute, another block, another stretch of the city. Soon, soon I cross the 10-mile mark. Holy shit, that's a lot of miles. I don't stop. I should, but I don't want to. I keep running the rest of the way to my flat, finishing finally at 11 miles when I slow my pace, panting, exhausted, spent. But utterly high on endorphins, too. No wonder Ethan liked this so much. It feels spectacular, like it does every damn time I run. I wipe my brow, unlock the front door and head into the entryway of my building, then up to the 3rd floor. Beads of sweat drip down my body. After I enter my flat, I fill a glass of water, down it, and then drink one more. As my breathing calms down, I strip out of my running shorts, step under the showerhead and turn the faucet to hot. The shower is the most welcome sight in the world. And then, unbidden, Joy joins me in it. This is getting to be hard. Pun intended. This isn't the first time she's come into the shower with me. I'd like to say I ignored the visit, but that'd be a lie. As soon as the image of her pops into my mind, I'm ready to go. We're talking a proposition-style hard-on. A picture last night, wandering by the Eiffel Tower, tugging her close as she snapped a photo of us. God, I'm so fucking transparent. The way I touched her, gathered her near, kissed her goodnight like I wanted it to last until the morning. I'm doing a terrible job at playing just friends, but every little crumb, every morsel makes me want more of her. Every brush of my fingers against hers makes me want to know what more of her would taste like, feel like, look like. I lean my head back under the stream, letting the water streak down my body, and then I take matters into my own hand. She's here with me, naked, wet, aroused, wrapped around me. I groan, grip myself harder. I see her lips red and inviting, lips I've longed for since the day I met her. I want a kiss, taste, and right now I want to fuck those lips. I want to slide my aching cock into that lush mouth and watch her take me deep, suck me hard. Lust jolts through my body as I let the fantasy play out. As I watch my cock thrust deeper into that perfect mouth, as I wind my hand into her wet hair, her lips are so tight around me. I jerk harder, tug faster, picturing what it would feel like to finally have her on her knees. But then I blink, shove the image away. That's not how I want joy right now. I know what my own orgasm feels like. Fantastic. I've been there, done that. Don't need to picture it. Instead, I want to do filthy things to her. I want to find her naked on my bed, wearing nothing but a white shirt I discarded earlier, unbuttoned and spread open, revealing those beautiful tits, rosy nipples and a soft belly. Rough, raw noises rumble up my throat as I shuttle my fist harder, faster, rocking into my hand. I imagine crawling down her body, licking a path between her tits, kissing to the paradise between her thighs. I picture flicking the tip of my tongue over her for the first time. Primal desire flares inside me, and I grunt as I imagine tasting her where she's wet and hot and needy. She arches her hips, begging, pleading, curling her hands around my head. I heed her call. Oh dear God, do I ever fucking heed it. I bury my face between those thighs, and then pleasure yanks me under, rockets through me as I come hard. A shudder racks my entire body, and I press my forehead to the glass door. Fuck, I mutter as water pelts my back. I groan loudly, a rough and hungry sound. An empty one, too. That felt absolutely great and utterly annoying. Because it's not real. It's not happening. And I'm going to have to fight like hell to pretend I don't want to do unholy things to her body when I see her again. And damn, do I want to see her again. I adjust the temperature in the shower, going lukewarm then cooler, forcing myself to stand under the stream as it chills. 10 minutes later, I'm showered, dressed, and still wanting her. Oh yeah. Turns out a shower wank doesn't evict joy from my brain, nor does an ice cube temperature shower either. From the kitchen counter, I grab the chocolate tart she gave me last night and devour it. I'm still hungry. But before I root around for something else to gnaw my way through in mere seconds, I snap a photo of the paper the tart was wrapped in. There's one crumb left. She'll like this. I send her the shot. Griffin. There's nothing quite like a 10-mile training run followed by a chocolate tart. By the way, thanks for dessert for breakfast. It was delicious and I thought of you. I look at the sent message. Well, it's not totally obvious I have it bad for her. It was delicious and I thought of you, I mouth to myself. Could I be any more blatant? I shake my head and sigh heavily. I set down the phone. Maybe I ought to try not thinking about her for a full minute. I grab my phone and click open a word game. This one helps keep my Spanish in shape as I have to steer letters, Tetris style, into words. But as I form sobra, my phone buzzes. I exit the game so quickly that I leave the A free-falling. So much for playing it cool as the letter crashes to a cruel death. Joy. My, my, aren't you quite the warrior? I'm still lounging in my jammies, drinking coffee and eating bonbons. Griffin. What kind of jammies? Look, I can't help myself. When a gorgeous woman says she's in PJs, I'm required, on account of being male, to ask what she has on, especially since she was naked in my shower mere minutes ago. Joy. A corset, Griffin. I sleep in a corset. It's black lace. I wear stockings and garters too, as well as stilettos. I crack up. She's on to me. Griffin. Ah, that sounds quite comfy. I find it quite pleasant myself to sleep in a tailored suit. Two can play at this game after all. Joy. You don't say. I might need a picture of that. My stomach rumbles, reminding me of the other important matter at hand, sustenance. I open the fridge. A jar of pickles stares forlornly at me. I scratch my jaw, wondering why I even have pickles. I don't remember buying them. I take a photo of the pickles and send it to Joy. But before I can add a note to explain why I'm sending the picture, a text from her lands on my screen. Joy. Why, I thought you'd never ask me to go pickle shopping with you. I accept. Smiley. Griffin. I'm starving. I'm off to get some breakfast. Petit déjeuner to you. I'd invite you to come with me and teach you scintillating phrases about eggs and coffee and bread, but you'd need to get out of your jammies rather quickly since 10+ miles of running has made me rather ravenous. So have thoughts of you coming on my lips. Joy. You have no idea how quickly I can get out of bed when breakfast is involved. Griffin. By the way, have you been to the Musée Marmottan Monet? If not, it's quite lovely and it's open today. Joy. This will come as a complete and utter shock, but like nearly everyone else in the world, I love Monet. Oh, and yes, you can take me out to breakfast and to see some million-dollar art, Griffin. So, yeah, that means I'm completely transparent to her. Brilliant. As I leave, I remind myself not to make it so patently unmistakable that I like her during breakfast. But when she arrives at the cafe wearing tight jeans, a light blue shirt and a red bandana around her hair like a headband, it's a lost cause. You had that on the first time I met you, I say, pointing to the cloth in her hair, the ends tied in a little knot, its tails poking out under her ear. Her lips quirk up. En français? You caught me, I say with a laugh. You remember? She runs her fingers over the red fabric. I nod, keeping my words simple so she understands. I remember. I thought it was bold. You look like Rosie the Riveter. Her eyebrows rise. You know Rosie? That's so American. I happen to like American things, I say. And when her green eyes lock with mine, I watch as understanding registers in them. As the words turn in her head till she knows what I mean. The moment she does, her eyes sparkle, then hold mine. She doesn't look away. I like English things. Evidently, we're both rubbish at friendship. I lean back in the chair and sigh. Being friends, so easy, yeah? Might as well call a spade a spade. So simple, she says dryly, her hand rising to fiddle with the bandana, as if she's going to take it out. No, seriously, it's so incredibly you, I tell her, reaching across the table, brushing my finger against the fabric, then down a soft strand of her hair. The red locks slide over my hand. I raise my gaze. Her lips part the slightest bit as I let go of her hair. She watches as the strands fall against her chest. She clears her throat and taps the menus. We better order, or the specter of pickles will haunt you all day. Best to avoid pickle hauntings. I tell her what I want, and when the waiter arrives, I let her order. She gets it right, and I'm more pleased than I should be, because it's her. Soles of shoes echo across the hardwood floors in the quiet mansion that houses more than 300 Monets. A handful of other museum-goers flit by, but we aren't packed like sardines. I gesture to all the space. The best part is it isn't crowded like the Musée d'Orsay or the Louvre. It's a little secret in Paris, she says as we wander through gallery after gallery of Impressionist art. I switch back and forth between languages, teaching her new words and phrases as we go. She's a fast learner with a nimble mind. She stops in front of one of the many images of the Japanese bridge the famous artist painted. I want to see the bridge, she says, and a burst of pride flares in me, since she said that correctly on her first try. We should go to Giverny. Then I stop, processing what I just said to her. The weight of it. The intention of it. I invited her to Monet's gardens. That doesn't sound like something a teacher would say to a student, but rather a man to a woman. A woman he wants to romance. Those wide green eyes give me her yes. Then her words do too. I want to go. My heart springs around in my chest, and it's the strangest sensation, a nearly foreign feeling, one I haven't experienced in a long time. The last few years have been dictated by the fallout from one unexpected event, so I haven't had the time or the inclination to feel anything more than the occasional bout of desire. I've never been. She shoots me a curious look.
You haven't? How is it possible there's a place near Paris you've never traveled to?
Miracles do happen.
I'm shocked,
she teases, then drops her hand and returns her focus to the painting of the bridge.
I read a novel once where paintings came alive.
How so?
In the story, the Degas dancers at the d'Orsay twirled out of their frames after hours. They performed ballets in the museum. The cat in Manet's Olympia jumped from his painting and padded across the tiled floor once the sun fell. It was like Night at the Museum meets Midnight in Paris. And in the story, the hero could travel through Monet's bridges to other museums around the world that had one of his paintings of the bridge, since he painted so many.
I chuckle. Sounds quite fantastical. She laughs.
It was magical. But I think that's the power of great art. It not only transports you, but makes you want to crawl inside and live in it.
Do I need to hold you back from trying to jump inside a Monet, Joy? Are you warning me of your intention to launch headfirst into a famous work of art? She brings her hands together in front of her as if prepping to dive. Her eyes are quizzical as she poses the next question.
If you were going to jump inside any painting, what would it be?
I marinate on that for a minute, considering. I suppose if these bridges really do transport you, I'd go into one of those Monets. Easy way to travel, right? Sort of like apparating in Harry Potter. I could be at the Hermitage in St. Petersburg like that. I snap my fingers.
Do you want to go to Russia?
I want to go everywhere, I say as I stare at the red and gold sunset version of the bridge in front of me.
You're a globetrotter, aren't you?
I'm an aspiring globetrotter, I say. It's what I've wanted to do since I can remember. Pack my bags, see the world, sleep under the stars.
We need to get you in these paintings then.
I point at the one in front of me. I could take that bridge to New York, another to Boston. I bet one of Monet's bridges is in Tokyo. I've always wanted to go there too, to see how vibrant and bright the city is.
Then you'll go.
She bumps shoulders with me.
If you want something badly enough, you make it happen.
I have to wonder if that includes someone too, or if her work and mine will stand in the way before I chase my desire to cross all the bridges to everywhere.
Chapter 17. Joy. I'm hot for teacher.